Brought to you by Moonbeam Multimedia.
This is 16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning.
Hi, hello.
Good morning.
Welcome to summer break.
Good afternoon, wherever you're listening. Hello.
Our first episode of your vacation of 2024. How are you settling in?
I still have the Sunday scaries.
Yeah.
That's so disappointing.
You spent all of yesterday pacing around the house nervously. And I was like, what are you doing?
I really did.
It was so confusing.
I was deep in my head about it. Well, I didn't have them last week because the holiday was Monday.
Uh-huh.
So like in my head, I didn't have to have Sunday scaries. So I skipped them. But then this week they came back.
Makes perfect sense.
No, it doesn't, but thank you for saying that. Well, I will say, though, can I give just a quick plus five to my body? Because I have woken up every day since summer break started by 6:12. And that's just good looking out.
It's conditioning.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when do you get to rest and relax?
Mid-July.
You know? Ah, and right before you start, go back to school.
Yes.
Okay.
Anyways, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm enjoying your summer.
Yeah.
To see more of you.
That's nice.
Yeah. And I'm
sorry. It's only been a week so far.
I'm sorry that you're still getting up at 6:12.
That's okay.
By
it's 6:12. Just by 6:12. Yeah.
By 6:12.
That's been the latest I've woken up on my own.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What are you looking forward to in the next couple of weeks of your summer break? Are you taking any time off? Are you doing anything interesting?
Well, I'm going to be going to the pool. My parents have a pool.
Uh-huh.
That's top priority. And we are actually, I don't know if we talked about, we would have talked about them last summer when we met them, our friends from Seattle.
Uh-huh. We did talk about them.
We did talk about them on the pod. So our friends from Seattle that we spent 4 days with camping at the Gorge for a Joni Mitchell concert reached out and wanted to meet us in New York City for a few days.
We had not met these people before that trip. We met them there and they fed us and made us happy when it was pouring rain.
And took care of us.
Hot food and
so wonderful.
It was nice.
Such a great time with them. So they reached out and we're going to go meet them in New York for a few days and see Suffs on Broadway.
We are.
I'm really excited for that trip. I'm excited to see them again. I love that we have made this really cool bond with these women. So I'm excited to see them. And I love being in New York.
Me too.
So
I can't wait for that trip.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we've officially mentioned it on the pod yet, but you also have an academic-related event going on this summer. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can finally formally share this. I was chosen as one of the 15 educators selected nationwide by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum to join its museum teacher fellowship program for the 24-25 cohort. The educators were chosen for their knowledge of the Holocaust history, successful teaching experience, and participation in community and professional organizations and events. In July of 2024, the fellows will participate in a multi-day Pine, Sarna, and Statfield Summer Institute for the Museum Teacher Fellowship Program, where they'll develop their historical knowledge and training methods to help advance quality teaching about Holocaust history and foster a network of leaders in the field of Holocaust education. And if you have an interest in finding out more about the fellowship or the Belfer conference that they put on or anything related to getting involved as a teacher with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, you can write in to us and I can send you the links and the info and the press releases for you to read through and see if any of that interests you. So I'll be talking about that more once I complete it and I'll be working on it for the next year. But I will be spending a few days in July in D.C. at the museum, kind of being trained and learning and doing all of that, and then bringing it back home and sharing it with my community.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited for that opportunity for you.
I feel very fortunate, and I'm excited to get to go.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're going to get into our education news headline roundup, but before that, just a quick announcement. We want to remind you to sign up for the 16-1 podcast email newsletter. Get the latest updates, episode announcements, resources, and workshop offerings from Moonbeam Multimedia. That's us. Anything on your end? Any announcements? Anything
no.
I'm forgetting? Housekeeping?
That was my announcement.
Well, let's just get into the news headline roundup then. This is where we analyze the most interesting and compelling headlines from around the world about all things learning, teaching, and leading in schools and other educational organizations. We'll stick all of our sources for these in the show notes for each episode, and you can find those, all of those show notes, on our website at 1601.com/archives. Our first headline of the week. This is kind of a wild one. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has leveled criticism at the landmark Brown versus Board of Education decision just days after the 70th anniversary of the ruling. In his concurring opinion on a decision allowing South Carolina to keep using a congressional map that critics say discriminated against black voters, Thomas this month argued that the Brown decision took a, quote, boundless view of equitable remedies, end quote, and involved, quote, extravagant uses of judicial power, end quote, to end racial segregation in schools. Thomas's opinion attempts to defang the Supreme Court's power to grant equitable relief. And that's just what that means. Is it's like legal rather than monetary action that tries to guarantee that justice is delivered in a given case. Incidentally, he also argued that redistricting remedies rest on the same questionable understanding of equitable power. So that's why he was talking about the Brown v. Board case, is because he doesn't think that, in my opinion, doesn't seem to think that the Supreme Court can actually do anything to remediate redistricting cases. Like, he's like, this is too much power that the court is taking. We're just kind of making up remedies on the fly, and we're supposed to look at judicial precedent to construct remedies, right? Mm-hmm. Which in one way makes sense, but he also said that there's like no federal precedent for what a remedy for redistricting looks like, which suggests to me that you can't rely only on historical case precedent. To make these decisions, because guess what? People and governments will continue to evolve and will continue to create new problems of governance.
For sure.
And anyway, just really interesting. It makes me wonder what he thinks would be a reasonable remedy.
Yeah.
Based either on statutory or inherent authority. I really just don't know. But his stance seems to run somewhat counter to the unanimous 1954 ruling, the Brown ruling, that declared racial segregation in public schools unconstitutional and catalyzed the civil rights movement.
Okay.
So.
Okay, Clarence.
Okay. What's our second headline for
me? Okay. Just a really strong pivot. The Delaware College of Art and Design announced its closure, attributing the decision partly to financial difficulties exacerbated by ongoing issues with the free application for federal student aid system. Concurrently, the U.S. Department of Ed has pledged a comprehensive review of its financial aid office and the entire process going into the free application for federal student aid system. This review aims to address and resolve the systematic issues that have led to financial instability for schools like the Delaware College of Art and Design, which may not be the only school to close.
I'm actually surprised there haven't been more of these cases yet, and I don't think this will probably be the last one.
I think there will absolutely be more.
Yeah, I looked up a little bit of information about this college. It's really small, and it hasn't been around for all that long. It wasn't founded until like the 90s, maybe 90.
That's too bad.
Or 97 or something. So they haven't been around a long time, and I just can imagine, especially for smaller colleges who are probably already on the brink with the enrollment cliff that is hitting higher ed now, and also just shifting economic and social priorities that are impacting higher ed. This sort of thing with the FAFSA application could spell easy disaster for all kinds of institutions like that. And I'm sure this wasn't the only problem that was plaguing DCAD. I'm sure that there were, you know, compounding issues here.
Sure.
But I could easily imagine small colleges going out of business and maybe even like suing the DOE over this rollout because it was so utterly disastrous and avoidable.
I don't think that's wrong either.
I don't. I just, yeah.
I mean, if they have created the system in which we have to abide by, then the system should work.
Yeah. I think that there are going to be ripple effects from this, and that this is probably not the only school closure that we're going to see as a result.
For sure.
We'll keep following that. And then our final story is a follow-up to a headline that we first shared in February of this year. I believe it was in our first Supreme Court case episode where we covered this, but we talked about Harvard University and this idea of institutional neutrality. So Harvard University's Institutional Voice Working Group has concluded its work and has recommended that Harvard leaders not issue, quote, official statements about public matters that do not directly affect the university's core function, end quote.
Hmm. What do I feel?
Well, so Harvard had a lot of reasons to do this now. And I will say they were kind of catching up to other peer institutions who already had institutional neutrality principles in place, mm-hmm. Or policies. I think in a very general way, I would feel better attending a university that didn't seem to have its mind already made up about certain controversial and political issues.
Allow them to change and evolve over time.
Well, it seems like, yeah, it just seems like institutional neutrality as such is important because it allows a space for students to come to their own conclusions and, you know, develop critical thinking skills. And that does seem important. But I do wonder at the same time if part of the core function of a university and maybe even the sort of radical act of education itself would include some responsibility to occasionally make public statements on sometimes controversial topics. I don't know. It seems like the project of education itself is a little bit at odds with institutional neutrality. And that's not to say that I think that education should therefore be this game of bias all the time. But with the hyper-partisanism that is invading pretty much every corner of discourse, it's getting hard to find topics that aren't controversial, particularly when it comes to leadership at higher ed. And I guess the other question is whether or not this can be seen as a sort of capitulation that the project of rational disagreement needs to be abandoned altogether. I don't know. I'm kind of of two minds about it, as you can see, because I as a student would probably feel uncomfortable attending a university that seemed to make up its mind for me. But on the other hand, there are matters of public relevance that I feel like I would want my school to maybe say something about sometimes. I don't know.
I don't know.
That's a tricky one.
It is.
And I think that even in the policy that they came up with, they're like, well, there can be reasonable disagreement about what issues qualify as having to do with the university's core function. They're like, people are not going to always agree on what that means. Yeah. So there's going to be some room for interpretation here. So I think this is more like a CYA move by Harvard because
seems so.
Because of what was happening there with the resignation of Claudine Gay, and just it's just been hard for them. And they're making appeals to alumni and being like, yeah, sorry, we had a hard year. Hope y'all stick around and keep engaging with us.
Hey, don't forget to make a donation by this date.
Yeah. This week, we are bringing you a nostalgia cast.
This is fun.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about Miss Frizzle in the Magic School
Frizzle.
Bus. One of our faves.
Definitely. And I will say this is a bit of a personal indulgence to be able to go back and learn a little bit about the show now as an adult. Some of the stuff we've been doing on edutainment and, you know, science programming and stuff for younger learners, it's just gotten me kind of interested in revisiting some of these old classics. So we're talking about the Magic School Bus. Take us through a little bit of the history of how the show got started, because it didn't start out as a show, right?
So Scholastic, their vice president and their senior editorial director, Craig Walker, wanted to combine science and fictional stories. So they knew in the late 80s, early 90s, this was kind of the target of where they needed to be working, right?
Edutainment has been around for longer than that, but this is, I think, when it started to come into its own with modern media.
For sure. So Scholastic is aware of that, right? Mm-hmm. So they're trying to obviously not only make a book, but also make things that are worth their while. The Magic School Bus started as a children's book series, and it was written by Joanna Cole, and it was illustrated by Bruce Deegan. And the first book came out in 1986, and the series was designed for 6 to 9 year olds. And over time, they've sold 93 million copies in 13 countries. And up until Harry Potter was released, they were the best-selling franchise for Scholastic. Those are big numbers. If you've only lost to Harry Potter,
yeah,
you're doing okay.
I didn't realize that it started out as books. Mm-hmm. I really, and that's weird because I would have been big into reading at this time.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, I guess maybe I would have read a book or two, but I don't have strong memories of the books. I have strong memories of the TV show.
When we talked about this, my mom immediately was like, yeah, it was a book. So I don't know if I read the book first or second. So okay. Cole, she's a former elementary school librarian. She wrote more than 250 books. And the first of her books was called Cockroaches.
Cockroaches.
It was about cockroaches.
Oh.
And she said it was because there had never been a book written about cockroaches at the time, which sounds exactly like something that an elementary school librarian would say.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
So her daughter did an interview, and of course, all of our sources are listed in our show notes. But her daughter did an interview after the passing of her mom and said that the cockroaches that she used to kind of study and understand for her book, she kept in her apartment. And one day that container flipped over and they escaped.
Oh, no.
And she had named one of the cockroaches Grace because her, like, antennae, I don't know, is that what cockroaches have?
Sure.
I'm not going to pretend to understand cockroaches, but should read the book. She called her Grace because it was so graceful. And so she refused to kill the cockroaches. Grace was pregnant.
Oh.
And so she basically willingly infested her entire apartment with cockroaches because she loved them so much after learning about them to write a book. So there's that.
That's gross, so but also fascinating.
If you understand that, then you understand everything about Miss Frizzle that there is to understand.
For real.
Yes.
For real. Because I don't think Miss Frizzle would kill the cockroaches either.
Oh, no. There's no way.
Miss Frizzle is a cockroach pacifist.
100%.
Okay.
So from those books, though, it evolved into a TV show, and it ran from 1994 to 1997 on PBS and on other networks for years after that.
Yeah.
And now, if you're wanting to watch it, it and its reboot are all on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So the original and, might I say, beloved TV show, the fourth grade teacher, Miss Frizzle, takes her students on extraordinary field trips aboard a magical, shape-shifting school bus. These adventures explore science topics like space, the human body, and ecosystems, turning complex subjects into fun and engaging lessons.
Yes. There was also, as a part of the Magic School Bus franchise, there was an educational video game series. It was published under the Microsoft Home brand. I was obsessed with these. I think I mentioned before that I was lucky to have computers around the house because my dad was working in software in the kind of early days of consumer computing. Like, he started his company when computers would take up entire rooms and had, like, ran on punch cards and stuff like that. But anyway, that meant that I got some of the cast-off computers and got to play with them growing up. And so I leaned in really hard to this video game series. And I have such fond memories of playing Magic School Bus video games, especially the Outer Space one. That was a big deal for me. And then the Human Body one, that was another.
Did you find any emulators when you were researching?
You know, some of these are on the Internet Archive, the video games, but the one that I really wanted to run for some reason would not run on the DOSBox emulator on the Internet Archive.
Darn.
That's the Outer Space one. So I can probably find another way to run it, but I'm not sure if it was like a memory limitation or what, but it would not
run. That's too bad.
I know. I really want to play it. So anyway, okay. Tell us about like the main characters and their roles.
Yeah. So most importantly is the Frizz, Miss Valerie Frizzle. She's the eccentric oddball and fourth grade teacher at Walkerville Elementary.
Walkerville, by the way, named after Craig Walker, that VP that we mentioned earlier.
She's voiced by Lily Tomlin. We love our Lily Tomlin. And so the Frizz, as the kids call her, Miss Frizzle, is probably most well known for her kind of cry, which is, let's take chances, make mistakes, and get messy.
Yeah.
Which I love for a fourth grade classroom.
Yes, absolutely.
You might remember the class pet lizard, Liz.
Uh-huh.
Who
I
is
do.
Always into something. She's always in the thick of it.
Oh, Liz is a girl? Who knew?
Well, her name's Liz, so I went with it. Her name's Liz Ard.
Liz Ard. Okay.
And then the students have all the normal tropes of a classroom. We have the class clown, the know-it-all, the whiz kid, the worrier.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites is the young boy who's always like, I should have stayed home today.
Is that Arnold?
Arnold, yeah.
I told you we rewatched a whole bunch of episodes for research for this, and I was like, oh man, I'm strongly recalling how much I identified with Arnold.
Yeah, and then there's like Ralphie, and Ralphie is kind of like probably like the jock.
He's like the popular kid.
Yeah, he's like the stereotype jock, but he like, you can tell that like Miss Frizzle makes him want to learn. You know what I mean? Like things like that. So,
yes, absolutely.
The one thing worth mentioning about the classroom is it does not do much justice to the actual education system, because I think her classroom ratio is like 8 to 1.
Oh,
she's a
yeah.
very small class.
That's a fun, that's an interesting point. I think I was reading where in the books there were more like 30 students.
Yeah.
Which is
normal.
The student to teacher ratio, mm-hmm. it's a little closer there, but yeah, they for some reason whittled it down to 8 for mm-hmm. the TV show.
And the other thing that I will give the early 90s TV some credit, there's some racial diversity in the classroom.
Yeah.
But for the 90s, that was probably pretty, you know.
Well, when you and I were talking about this, it brought up memories of when I was a kid. So we both originate from overwhelmingly white parts of the country. Mm. We're from rural Ohio, and there is not much in terms of racial diversity around here, and especially not more so now, but not when we were growing up.
Yeah.
And so we were a very white school, and I remember asking questions about that. Mm-hmm. Like I remember being like, what's the deal here? Mm-hmm. These people all look different from what I'm, you know, from people yeah. I'm used to seeing in the classroom. What is that about?
Yeah.
So it definitely sparked conversations, yeah. I would say. I will also say that in reading a little bit about the rebooted series, there were people who had some qualms with the animation choices. Apparently, maybe some people who felt that it had become a bit whitewashed. Mm. I didn't pick up on that because I was kind of trying to pay attention to it. And it looked to me like the class was kind of similarly diverse to the original show.
They were most of the same characters.
I don't know. I don't know exactly the nature yeah. of the issue. I don't know if it was just like they chose lighter skin tones.
Sure.
Whereas before it was, you know, gotcha. It was more representative. I'm not sure what the issue was. But yeah. anyway, it was a good diverse cast at the time,
yeah.
for sure.
And the maybe the most important character of the whole show is the bus.
The bus.
The bus shapes and shifts and does all kinds of things. It can turn into basically any size.
Yes.
It has all kinds of capabilities. They have great funding for this bus. I don't know what kind of grant they've gotten, but that is one expensive bus. And so Miss Frizzle drives the bus, and the bus does as she needs it to for the sake of the adventure.
Yeah, I don't
whatever
think
that may be.
That part is a little less than realistic, because I don't think that you can just hop on a school bus and drive it when you need to take your kids on a field trip, can you?
It's getting closer to needing to do that, I will say.
But can you, or do you have to have like
no,
a special thing
no, you
to
have
drive?
A CDL.
Yeah, that's
you
what I thought. You had to have a CDL. So
Miss Frizzle would have a CDL.
She has a CDL.
She would have to.
Okay.
Her outfits change to whatever is happening in the classroom that day.
She's magic.
So she doesn't need a CDL.
So the reason we're interested in this show and remain interested in it, because now that I went back and watched a few episodes, I feel like I want to keep going down memory lane and watch more of them. But we're talking about the educational impact of the show. And I think its main point was to show that learning can be fun and engaging. Mm-hmm. At least for me, it accomplished that goal. It got me very excited about stuff that I wouldn't otherwise necessarily have been interested in. You know, it would discuss all kinds of scientific concepts, lessons, just a few examples, the solar system, dinosaurs, understanding illnesses, infections, and fevers, the gastrointestinal system. That was a whole wild ride. The 2017 reboot brought in new episodes on things like invasive species and the International Space Station. There was a cameo in that episode by Commander Chris Hadfield, which was kind of cool.
That was cute.
They did him justice with his cartoon version. It looked just like him.
Well, because you laughed when I said Commander Hadfield, and because you know and have studied and know everything about Chris Hadfield, it seems. But then when they showed him, I was like,
I promise,
that has to be him.
Yes. I promise I'm not obsessed with Chris Hadfield. I just really appreciate his work. And I really liked his cover of Space Oddity that he did in space. That was one of the coolest things
ever. And you watched his masterclass.
I did. I watched his masterclass, and I learned a lot about orbital mechanics.
Yeah. So it was a really fun episode, though. So mm-hmm. it was cool to see him make an appearance. And they did him and his mustache justice.
Yeah. So just to talk a little bit about the show's pedagogical approach, because as we mentioned, this is kind of one of the, at least for a certain generation of learners, this is one of the early templates of what edutainment mm-hmm. looks like. we noticed lessons from teaching early learners how you do that. So we would notice things like the show will repeat important concepts and ideas and like vocabulary, weird things like that. It'll repeat those things to make sure that they've kind of sunk in, not like in an annoying way, but they'll just revisit things that they first mentioned.
Just restate
earlier. It. Yeah, restate it, rephrase it, make sure everybody's understanding.
I mean, I was picking up on how they would, like you said, they would restate things, but Ms. Frizzle said it differently. So like she actually was really good at that. And the writers were very in tune with what kind of speech patterns a teacher would have, right? Uh-huh. To know how to say the same thing multiple ways to multiple learners.
She's also a very gentle communicator, I would just say.
She's like
patient and gentle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like gentle parenting as a person, it's Ms. Frizzle for sure. But also, is there a better way to teach kids and to take them directly to the thing that they're learning about? In episode 2, they took them directly to the intestines. So what is better than that? And also, like, there were some really funny, like, tongue-in-cheek moments kind of that happened in that episode because the kids all realized that, like, one way out is by waste, if you will.
Waste management.
Yes. And all the kids are like, no, we don't. And she makes a comment that's like, do you think we'd show this on public? Or was it the producer that made a comment that was like, we wouldn't show this on public television?
Yeah. Yeah.
So even something as gross as poop, they handled really well. And
by not handling it. Yeah. I thought that was actually really clever. They were like, well, we don't really want to go that way. Let's go the way we came in.
Right.
And they kind of like don't get explicit about why they don't want to go that way.
But you can tell the kids know.
Uh-huh.
On the bus, I mean.
Uh-huh. There's and like so, kind of winking and nodding.
Yeah. And so, I don't know. I just thought that was so funny. And I always liked the Magic School Bus more than I liked Bill Nye.
Oh, and interesting.
I think it was because of how literally deeply inside of the thing that they could go.
Uh-huh.
Because that's how I'm a learner. That's how I have to learn. And so, yeah. I love that they were able to just go right to the thing
mm-hmm.
and be like, well, this is this part of the intestine. And all the kids are like, ew.
Well, yeah, I like that's what you're talking about. It's using the magic of the concept and of the field trip and getting a little creative with that. And, you know, and kids are already, at least when I was a kid, I will speak for myself. I don't know if kids still feel this way about field trips, but field trips were like very exciting days where you had to do something out of the norm. So capitalizing on that educational experience where you're shaking things up and bringing young learners directly to the source of, you know, whatever they're learning about that day.
Mm.
It's kind of how the show runs on that excitement. And you were kind of mentioning this, but we also notice a lot of differentiated instruction going on, even in the modeling of the classroom, the Ms. Frizzle's classroom, like the way that she approaches different students with different either tone or like learning goals
or like speaks to them.
Yeah. In the reboot, I noticed one of the like know-it-all students, the Frizz kind of set her up to realize that she was being a bit of a know-it-all, but on her own terms and in a way that wouldn't be like super embarrassing or
crushing
like to
damaging.
Her. Yeah, but she set her up to be in this position where she could learn from how she was acting and how what she, you know, this student was not being well received by her peers because she was being bossy.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just think that's interesting. I do think that not only in the interpersonal, social, emotional stuff, but even with the learning goals in the classroom, you can see Ms. Frizzle reaching different students in ways or like slightly modifying the assignment for somebody or whatever it is. It's like, it's good classroom practice.
It is.
Even for a cartoon.
She would score really well on a teacher evaluation, I think, because there's differentiated learning. When they go into the classroom, like students have different roles and they do different things and like they all kind of like check each other and help each other. So she's made a really safe learning environment for these students.
Yeah. There was even a very intentional discussion of classroom roles in the very first episode of the reboot and the 2017 reboot because there's a new teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's Ms. Frizzle's younger sister and she comes in and teaches and it kind of gets the students a little upset because things are changing and they're kind of uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
But part of that discussion was, oh, well, we all have roles in this classroom that are a little bit different. And they went through, you know, all the students do this, blah, 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 blah. And the teacher does this. They also have a new student come and join in the reboot. They bring her in to focus on newfangled technology.
Yeah.
They're like, Internet girl, come here.
Right.
And she's always like on computers and devices and stuff.
In the original show, it was kind of implied that they had a foreign exchange student.
Yeah.
And so that was like that spot in the classroom, if you will, was kind of replaced by the
nerdy girl
who came in.
Right. I think they said that the exchange student went back to her home school at the very beginning of the reboot. And then one other pedagogical approach that I found just absolutely delightful when we were rewatching this, and I kind of forgot that this was a mechanism in the original show.
And there are some people who might not know that this happened in the show.
That's true, because it was sometimes cut for time, depending on what...
If you had it with ads or not.
Yeah, but there's this... At the end of most episodes, there's this moment, and this is in the original series, I will say. There's this, like, fourth wall breaking thing, kind of mechanism. There's this... thing they have where young learners
from all over the world
voices, you can tell they're young voices, but they call in, and this is all still within the cartoon, so they've animated all of this, but they have young learners call in to the Magic School Bus to talk to a producer of the show, again also animated. The young learners will call in and ask questions about or challenge some creative liberties that get taken during the course of telling the stories in the show. So they'll gently correct the producers on things sometimes. And the producers would be like, well, yeah, that's not really how it works, but we did it this way because the network wouldn't let us do that. It's so funny. When you were talking about the exiting out the digestive system, the producer was like, yeah, we're not. Do you think that would be appropriate for public television? And the kid was like, no, not really. And I think the other moment that I remembered like that was, and it was even kind of funny because when we were watching the episode, I was freaking out about it. But when they go to Pluto in the Lost in Space episode and Arnold takes off his helmet, I was like, that's bad. Arnold should not do that on Pluto. I was having a moment where I was like, not good on science there, because if Arnold really took off his helmet on Pluto, Arnold would not be coming home. So anyway, I was a little distraught by that. And then in that fourth wall breaking thing at the end, the kid was like, Arnold would have turned into a block of ice if he'd done that.
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, he probably couldn't have taken off his helmet. That was kind of just for the story. So anyway, I really appreciated that it trusted young learners with creative liberties and explain the creative liberties, and also allow for this moment where it's like, yeah, we can kind of fudge it or not be quite true to the, you know, to the reality of science to get people interested or to make the story fun or whatever. I just think it's so interesting that an educational show is taking responsibility for the creative liberties that it takes. So
yeah, me too. I like that part.
It was very fun for me. I don't know why that was so delightful, but I really like the opportunities to gently correct inaccurate or misleading moments, especially with regard to the science.
Yeah. Well, and that was part of the reason why Lily Tomlin took the role and loved Miss Frizzle so much when she voiced her. And it was because she loved that Miss Frizzle could do it all. She could help make science reachable for kids. She could drive the bus. She could make it exciting. She could make it fun. And so I think we see that in Miss Frizzle, like every single episode, like with her outfits, her earrings, like everything she does is just like, she's like the most dedicated teacher I can think of.
You can definitely see the effort made.
And I think that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So obviously the show, even before the reboot, held a special place in a lot of people's hearts. A lot of people our age, probably in their mid 30s now. And so the cultural influence is pretty obvious. But we actually talked to a couple of our friends who have young ones right now who said that they still love watching the show with their little ones. And they like the new and the original. And we watched, we've definitely seen less of the new one, but we enjoyed what we watched of the new one. And I will say that a lot of my students have talked about watching The Magic School Bus. And they would have been at least a generation after the release. You know what I mean?
So they were talking about the original.
Yeah. And they remember watching it in school, some of them, and some remember watching it at home, which means that their teachers were using it for whatever purpose in the classroom.
I will say,
which is really fun.
Yes. The couple of episodes that we watched have held up extremely well. I mean, it's pretty timeless for the most part, the topics covered, but
I mean, I think the cast has a lot to do with how this show has continued, because I remember my mom talking about Lily Tomlin being Miss Frizzle. And so people our age and older obviously will remember that. But they had some really great guest appearances and special episodes that came as part of the original series. Most famously, and I'll always love a reason to talk about Dolly Parton, but Dolly Parton plays Miss Frizzle's cousin Murph. And she sings a song about recycling. And in the show notes is a link to a YouTube video that talks a little bit more about Dolly Parton's appearance. But other famous people that appeared on the original series: Ed Asner, Winona Judd, Dan Marino, Alex Trebek, Rita Moreno. And a lot of the people that were asked to make appearances on the show said that just having Lily Tomlin on the show was good enough for them to say yes.
For sure.
Because they trusted her. And she did win a Daytime Emmy Award for Magic School Bus, the original series. Yeah.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. So the new show, though, is called The Magic School Bus Rides Again. And it has featured first of all, Miss Frizzle's little sister, Fiona Frizzle, is voiced by Kate McKinnon.
Mm-hmm.
But other people that have made appearances in the new series include Sandra Oh, Will Arnett, Nathan Fillion, Catherine O'Hara, Martin Short, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, who voices a character but also did the song.
Yeah, sang, I think, performed the song. Mm-hmm. And it was Little Richard performed the original song, which I thought was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I get that theme song stuck in my head just randomly sometimes.
It's very catchy.
Yeah.
So the new series, though, it's the same school, Walkerville Elementary, and Miss Frizzle's little sister, like I said, Miss Fiona Frizzle, has taken over. The students are mostly the same as the original show, but there is the new girl that we talked about because another student sounds to have gone back to their original homeschool. And it doesn't seem to include a heavier focus on social-emotional learning, and that was something you and I kind of picked up on. It wasn't so heavy on facts.
Yeah.
Not that they weren't talking about the facts of something, but it wasn't quite as heavy-handed in that way.
That is probably my only point of critique that I noticed from the very few amount of episodes that we watched. The information density was not the same. And I am a sort of learner who was very enamored of the information density of the original show. Like, I was just like, fact, yeah. learning, information, learning, science. And I was like, that worked for me.
Yeah.
And it was something that I liked. And
I definitely like their relationships, like the friends.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad. I do think that it felt like there was more downtime for just like the narrative, the storylines to happen in the new, in the reboot. And I'm not super sure how I felt about it. I also felt like I didn't get quite as much personality from the students in the reboot as I did in the original, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we watched such a small amount of it, but it still, I really liked the, they did, I think, three slightly extended specials, and the International Space Station was one of those specials.
New season. Yeah.
Yeah. That episode is really fun because they accidentally turn a tardigrade into a giant space monster.
Just floating around after
yeah,
them.
Yeah. They accidentally enlarge a water bear and it becomes huge and floats around the ISS. It's
the girl's
so
like,
funny.
I would know those fat legs anywhere. That was so cute.
It's a cute one. So that was fun to watch, but those are the main points of difference. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting that both shows didn't really last all that long in terms of their broadcast run. And I mean, I appreciate the place that this show filled in my childhood and science education, for sure.
Can I tell you a little bit about the behind the scenes?
Sure.
Of the Magic School Bus?
Of course.
I fell down a rabbit hole yesterday.
Okay,
as I was researching. So I found a behind the scenes video on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It was taken from a family holiday special in 1996. So they had made a longer episode in 1996 that included some behind the scene footage. Now, when that episode was featured in reruns, they got rid of that part.
Oh.
So Dolly Parton's Vimeo page has the original. So the YouTube channel that I watched took it from that. So I've linked everything, but this is how I found it.
Okay.
So it featured the producers talking about what the most difficult parts of making the Magic School Bus, and that was mostly just finding ways for it to be entertaining and filling it with really solid science. And they wanted to understand the science the way that kids would.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that struggle was figuring out how to make the science part of the entertainment, but it was also trying to figure out what kids would understand to make science work. And so on the video I watched, it was a bunch of them sitting around a table of just like all of these gizmos and gadgets and like piecing together things that they could put in the episode that would work scientifically that kids could understand. And so it was really interesting to kind of hear their thought process of like how they would make a ladder out of gumdrops in bobby pins or something like mm-hmm. that. The way that the show was created, though, is that it was actually a combination of things from all over the world. Lily did all of her recording in the United States. All of the kids were in Canada, so they never recorded together. Hmm. The storyboarding and the ideas happened in Canada, and then the animation actually happened in Seoul, South Korea. In the interview, it showed a lot of the kids, and they all kind of made jokes about how they looked nothing like their characters, but they looked identical to their characters.
Oh, really?
Yes, they looked very similar to their characters.
Wow.
So they might have been some inspiration there.
That's interesting that they kind of, they did it that way rather mm-hmm. than, because they don't always, I wouldn't say they always cast that way. It's interesting.
Yeah, you can see some strong similarities in the kids and their characters. And then one last thing about Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton's special together, where Dolly is Murph, Miss Frizzle's cousin. They did record Murph and Miss Frizzle together in the same room. And it's just so much fun to watch Dolly and Lily feed off of each other for these episodes.
That would not be the first time that they have appeared in projects together.
No, they're dear friends and they love to support each other. And Dolly sings a song and it's all about how we could do better by recycling and things like that. And so I really encourage you to watch those. I included a link to a Twitter video where I found the original episode. Interview.
I will say that I think the Magic School Bus, I mean, Magic School Bus is the reason that I started to care a lot about a lot of science things, but ecology and environmental science and like, the effects of humans on ecosystems, that those were very much things that I learned first mm-hmm. from the Magic School Bus.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
So like I said, I'm a huge Lily Tomlin fan. So that was enough of a reason for me to go back and research it. But I love Dolly. And so it was really fun to see Lily Tomlin become Miss Frizzle.
Cool. Do you have a favorite episode of The Magic School Bus?
I remembered this one before we watched it. So I at least remembered it well enough for it to have stuck with me for 28 whatever years now. And it was just, it's called Inside Ralphie. Uh-huh. And Ralphie's homesick and he has a fever. And so, of course, the kids go on a trip to understand Ralphie's fever. They take the Magic School Bus to him and fly in through his knee. He's got a boo-boo.
Yeah.
He's got a scab.
It's gross.
It is. And they fly in through there and they
get into his bloodstream.
Yeah. And they are able to explain why he feels the way he does.
It's pretty accurate too.
Well, and it's really fun because they have like Rafi's mom like sitting on the bed with him for
a
while.
She's a medical doctor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so she's like adding to the kids' understanding of what they're seeing. And so it's a very clever way to make sure that what Ralphie is understanding is accurate about mm-hmm. his body. What about you?
Oh, the very first episode of the show.
It's great.
Which is The Magic School Bus Gets Lost in Space.
Of course.
I was absolutely obsessed with astronauts and outer space as a kid. And that has something to do with growing up in John Glenn's hometown. I think we've talked about that on the show before. But
yeah.
Astronauts were just everywhere.
Big deal.
Yes. And so I was super into that. They go to all the planets. The one know-it-all girl tries to collect little trinkets from all of the planets and fills up the bus and the bus can't handle it. It's fun. But I think I mentioned that before, but I also played the Magic School Bus Explores the Solar System video game obsessively. And the one thing I remember about that game is that I would be playing it before bed and I would not want to go to bed or not want to go do a chore or whatever it was. If I didn't want to stop playing the video game.
Sure.
Normal I would be like, stuff. I would just be like, okay, right after I finish this one thing, I will get up. And the little mini game mechanic is you put planets inside of the sun to get the relative size, right, a sense of it. And so I would fill up the sun with Mercury.
Because it took you forever.
Because it would take so long. So that was like one of the things that I remember from that game.
That's fun.
It stuck in my head. But I also remember the human body game, the ocean game, and the inside the earth one. That's the one with the collecting rocks and geodes.
Yeah, that's the one I remember, the rocks one.
How do you think the Magic School Bus compares to other educational shows from the same era? I think Bill Nye is the one that it gets.
Yeah.
It's in the same kind of era as Bill Nye.
And they were both on PBS for a long time. Mm-hmm.
Said you liked this better.
I did. Uh-huh. I think probably at that age I would have preferred anything animated though also.
Oh, interesting.
And so I think that was just a factor for me. The target audience for this is older, which mm-hmm. is great, because I think that actually what Bill Nye and Magic School Bus were targeting was a group of people that were not often targeted. I feel like they had early young TV really nailed down, but this is a little bit more like middle, you know, like probably like second through maybe fifth or sixth grade. So mm-hmm. that's a little bit wider. But I just love how it entertains, and I love that it doesn't take itself too seriously. Even for someone who is a more like hesitant learner as far as like science, I loved watching The Magic School Bus because I felt like I could enjoy the story and then I still was getting something from it.
That's what I heard when
I think that's important.
Yeah, I'm sorry. When I was asking some of our peer educators about this, mm-hmm. I was like, you know, how'd you feel about The Magic School Bus? And several of them said, well, I'm not a science person, yeah. but I love The Magic School Bus.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, and as a teacher, who doesn't want the absolute command of their classroom like Miss Frizzle? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. when I think about her as a teacher, like that's another reason why I probably love that show so much, is just that I knew from a young age I wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so I think I admired her ability to not only coordinate her outfits to the lesson of the day, but to also secure grant funding to make a bus that great. No. But I really do think, like, and this is so corny, I think she's a great teacher. And I think that's another reason why I loved her.
Mm-hmm. I'm also pretty passionate about the science communication aspect of the show. The way that it manages to engage, especially young learners, but just meeting people where they are without overly dumbing things down. That's yeah. really hard to do.
It is.
I also think that the show takes advantage of the natural curiosity of younger learners in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it properly recognizes that younger learners can be more malleable and they're able to be surprised by the world in yeah. ways that adults often aren't. Despite some pretty strong imposter syndrome elsewhere in my life, I've always been pretty confident in pursuing curiosities and doing research. Mm-hmm. And I would say that The Magic School Bus probably gave me some of that permission at a young age to do that taking chances mm-hmm. and making mistakes and getting messy thing.
Yeah.
And I still appreciate that even now. And I did want to say just like one final thing. I thought it was pretty interesting. We talked in the Fred Rogers episode that we did his aversion to attributing things to magic. He was like, no, imagination mm-hmm. is not magic. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to make this very clear.
Yeah.
He didn't want picture that TV screen mm-hmm. in the show to be magic. He wanted it to be technology.
The VHS, or yeah.
And he wanted a pretty clear delineation in the land of make-believe. He's like, this is also not magic. This mm-hmm. is imagination. So these things that are happening to you are not happening to you because of supernatural boogeymen.
Right.
So we have a different approach to that question yeah. here, because this show fully embraces magic.
Leans into it.
The bus is magic. Miss Frizzle is magic.
Yeah.
I admire Fred Rogers' principles and where he's coming from, but I also think that there's a little bit of magic in believing in magic for at least a little while.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, maybe it's this kind of noble lie that lets young learners mm-hmm. have fun learning with total abandon.
Yeah.
And not many of us get to experience that feeling except for a really short
time. And for not time. Long.
Yeah. For a really short time in our lives. So maybe there's something worth preserving and encouraging in believing in a mm-hmm. little bit of magic, which I think The Magic School Bus manages to do pretty well.
Yeah, I do too. Can I say one last thing?
Absolutely.
I forgot to mention this earlier, but I don't know where I was ever told or heard this quote, but it was basically that if you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this show does for me. It explains things really simply
yeah.
that are not so simple. And I think that's why I was able to remember specific. I mean, I could see parts of that Inside Rafi episode. Like, I remember so vividly
oh, yeah.
those platelets and things like
for
that.
For sure. So, I think that part of my own image of like medical science and health and bodily organs and stuff mm-hmm. is like when I imagine those things, the imagining is happening on the back of whatever it looked
yes.
like in The Magic School Bus.
Yeah.
For sure.
And so I feel like one thing I've always tried to do as a teacher is to understand something so well that I can explain it simply. It's probably in large part because of how well The Magic School Bus does that. Fill in the blank.
Yes.
This is the part where we ask you a question. You write us the answer at hello@16to1.com. We give you stickers.
We do.
That's how this works.
Write into us. We'd love to hear from you.
Last episode's question. Memorial Day in the USA was first observed on May 30th, 1868, as a way to commemorate the lives lost during the Civil War. After World War I, Memorial Day became the occasion to remember all those who died in America's wars. So, in 1971, Congress passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Act, which established that Memorial Day was to be commemorated on the last Monday of May. When it originally started, Memorial Day was called something else. What was its original name? It was called Decoration Day. All right, what you got?
June 6, 2024 marks the 80th anniversary of the Normandy landings during World War II. In 1944, the Allies invaded Normandy in what is still considered to be the largest seaborne invasion in history. We know this event as D-Day, but what was its code name?
All right.
Okay. What did you learn in the last couple of weeks?
Okay. As everyone knows, a big baseball fan, and recently the Major League Baseball has integrated stats from the Negro Leagues into their historical records. This research and data gathering has taken a long time to pull together, and finally it has all been combined. This has been something that people have been pushing for a very, very long time, because the Negro Leagues were obviously set up because they would not allow black men to play in the majors. So most notably of this shift in the historical record books, you'll find that the all-time career batting average leader has changed. It had previously been Ty Cobb, and it is now Josh Gibson. Josh Gibson has a career batting average of .372, and Cobb, the previous leader, batted the .367. And just to put these numbers into context for people that don't love baseball in the way that I do, a .372 batting average means that in 10 plate appearances, at least three times were a hit and up to four. This is a person that hit three or four times out of 10 appearances at the plate, and that is very hard to do. And so those record books have been completely shifted. It's very exciting, and it's been fun to see it. So,
cool.
What'd you learn?
Okay, well, I learned two completely unrelated, but both very interesting things. The first is that Japan is limiting tourism traffic, specifically to the Mount Fuji area. They're also
really
banning tourists from certain districts in certain cities due to overcrowding, harassment, photography without consent, and trespassing on private property.
Yikes.
I learned about this because I saw a video of what seemed to me to be pretty obviously a really obnoxious American tourist lady chasing a Japanese woman down the street to take photos of her. So anyway, that's how I was like, what is happening here? And then I did some research and I learned that, So Japan is like, yeah, no, we're not going to deal with this. We're not going to inconvenience our own citizens for the sake of foreign tourists. So we're putting some limits on this stuff. And okay. I feel like perhaps America, a couple of our more popular tourist destinations, could learn a lesson from this, because at a certain point, it becomes just not really fun to go experience a place because it's too crowded with other humans.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing I learned quickly was some of the details of the Voyager 1 probe fix. Have you heard about this?
I haven't.
Okay. So Voyager
1. This may surprise you, but I haven't.
Voyager 1 is a little spacecraft that has been floating deep in space for a really, really long time, but it had experienced an issue with one of its onboard computers. A portion of its memory was corrupted, and this was preventing Voyager from sending data back to Earth for like months and months. And people thought that this was like, this was the end of the decades-long Voyager mission, because I don't know if you know this, but it's, you can't just like swap in a new memory card for something that's like billions of miles away. So because they couldn't replace the hardware, they had to come up with a software solution. So they identified the corrupted memory location. They divided the code stored there into smaller pieces, moved this code around to different memory locations, changed and like updated the computer's memory so that the new locations would be able to be accessed by everything else running. So they sent the commands to implement the changes, and it successfully rebooted. And now Voyager 1 is once again transmitting data to Earth for the first time in months.
Way to go, Voyager.
This was really kind of amazing engineering
and technology.
Very cool. So I was happy to learn about that fix. So yeah,
neat.
That's what I learned. Okay.
You like space, huh?
I sure do. Thanks, Miss Frizzle.
Thanks, Miss Frizzle.
Listeners, thanks for supporting 16 to 1. We're your co-hosts. I'm Chelsea Adams.
And I'm Katie Day. Find our show notes, archives, and resources, sign up for our newsletter, or get in touch with us via the contact form at 16to1.com, all spelled out.
We are so grateful for our listener support. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to the show and telling your friends or colleagues about it.
The show is edited and produced by you, Chelsea Adams, and you're also responsible for our show's music.
And you, Katie Day, serve as lead researcher and social media manager.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next show.
Ooh, the Duke of Brunswick Waffenboodle. And the Duchess of Saxe Weissenfoss. I want to be the Duke of Brunswick Waffenboodle.